It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here with the latest from Drupal getting to the Telegram fiasco in Russia, TLS 1.3, and why you've got to turn off UPnP on your router. It's all coming up next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 659, recorded Tuesday, April 17th, 2018. Never a dull moment. Security Now is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Hiring? ZipRecruiter has revolutionized how you do it. Their technology identifies people with the right experience and then invites them to apply to your job. They find great candidates for you. Try it free today at ZipRecruiter.com/securitynow. And by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/securitynow. And by Eno, your intelligent assistant from Capital One. Shop online without using your real credit card number for your favorite merchant sites. For more information, visit CapitalOne.com/Eno/virtual numbers. It's time for Security Now, the show where we protect you and your loved ones online through the good offices of Mr. Stephen Tiberius Gibson. Although I might now want to call you Dr. Smith. Steve, oh.
we have that in the show.
We'll be talking about that, I'm sure.
That's right.
Steve is the guy in charge of GRC.com, the Gibson Research Corporation. I guess that's the eponymous Gibson Research Corporation. He's also the master in charge of SpinRite, the world's best hard drive recovery and maintenance utility. And for the last 10, 11, 12 years, he's been filling us in on what's going on in computing. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Leo. Great to be with you again. Elaine had a question from last week's audio, because I guess I made a comment that SpinRite was – we were talking about bugs and updating, and I said SpinRite was
bug free.
I said like 14 years old, but she immediately put her brakes on because she's listening to all this. She says, "Wait a minute, isn't it like 30 years old?"
What?
What I meant to say was SpinRite 6 was completed in 2004, and so here we are in 18, and we're getting ready. I'm getting ready, of course. Everyone knows to start returning to. And moving SpinRite 6 forward as soon as I get Squirrel put to bed. But so it was SpinRite 6.0 that is 14 years ago it was published. And much like the DNS benchmark was really – I was talking about the DNS benchmark and how I had updated it for the first time in 10 years because I finished it in – its last update was in 08. When I finished it. So anyway.
Yeah, you're saying the current version of SpinRite is that old.
Yes.
Which is remarkable for any software.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I didn't have any – there was like lots of news. I mean like lots of news. And so it's almost a good thing, a blessing, that there was no one huge dominant take up half the podcast story because then we wouldn't have been able to get to everything. And there was just lots of interesting things. So – I called this episode 659. I just labeled it "Never a Dull Moment."
That's the truth.
And boy, so we do have AMD's release of their much anticipated and somewhat long awaited, although hopefully they won't stumble out of the gate the way Intel did, their microcode updates for the Spectre Variant 2 problem, which cannot be fixed without hardware fixes in the processor by the operating system working in conjunction with the processor. So that just happened. We have some details about the very messy end of Telegram Messenger in Russia that we've been tracking for the last few podcasts, the on-time arrival of Drupal Geddon 2. It happened exactly as we anticipated it was going to, and so we've got that. Also, Firefox and TLS version 1.3, a new and widespread UPN proxy is what Akamai is calling these attacks. Microsoft's reversal on it's no longer providing Windows security updates without AV installed policy, which they announced at the beginning of the year. I mean, I remember we were all like, what? You know, what? So the idea, well, we'll talk about that in a minute. Google Chrome has made a decision, which they announced, to start as of October, which would be Chrome 70, to prematurely remove HTTP cookies, which is understandable, but kind of controversial.
How you do that? Yeah.
So we've also got the so-called Android patch gap, where Android OEMs have been discovered to be lying about how well patched their phones are. A renewal of worries over old and insecure Bitcoin crypto, new attacks on old IIS, a WhatsApp photo that was cleverly used by police for forensics, an IoT vulnerability straight from our "you can't make this stuff up" department, and more. So, yes. As yes. I said, never a dull moment.
Yes. So, yes, he says.
And some miscellany and a fun note, not a testimonial about SpinRite this week, but someone who's been like trying, he's like, he was waiting to give one and finally he got tired of waiting. So anyway, lots of fun stuff.
You know, sometimes the best testimonial is I don't really ever have to use it. I just, everything works.
That's actually kind of what he said. It's like, okay,
I haven't needed it. I just spin right ahead of time, and everything's good.
That's right.
Our show today brought to you by ZipRecruiter. If you're one of those people who does the hiring at your company, pat yourself on the back. Because that means you're the person that builds the company, builds the pieces that make a company. A company is really, in its purest form, all any company is the people who work at that company. It is getting people together to work toward a unified vision and a group of people doing that. It's one of the great inventions, frankly, of the modern era. The people who can do that are much more powerful than any individual. But it can be a house of cards, because if you get the wrong people in your company, they could tear the whole thing right down. The right people can take your company to the moon. The wrong people can bury it. And that's why hiring is, in my mind, the most important part of building a company. Every business needs great people. And I'm betting if you're doing the hiring, you also believe that every business needs a better way to find the perfect person, something than just, you know, putting your job on a job board and hoping and praying. Let's assume, I think this is a safe assumption, that somewhere out there is the perfect person for your job opening. How do you reach them? How do you maximize your reach? Well, ZipRecruiter knew there was a better way. They built a platform that finds the right job candidates for you. It starts with posting 100 on your job on ZipRecruiter, which posts it then to 100 plus job sites. So it sends out the word. But the other thing to keep in mind is that ZipRecruiter already has tens of millions of current resumes. So as ZipRecruiter learns what you're looking for, it can identify people with the right experience. It does this all automatically. They don't use the word AI, but honestly, it's kind of like that. And then ZipRecruiter invites them to apply to your job. This has revolutionized how you find your next hire. 80%, this is the salient fact, 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. Now, if you're shorthanded right now, you need ZipRecruiter. You could fill that position like that. And ZipRecruiter doesn't stop there, by the way. They even spotlight the strongest applications you receive. You know, all the applications, they don't go to your inbox or ring your phone. They go into the ZipRecruiter interface, at which point ZipRecruiter automatically goes through them and highlights the best candidates. So you never miss a great match. It pops right out at you. Look, the right candidate is out there for that opening you've got right now. You need to use the right tool. You need to use ZipRecruiter, because ZipRecruiter will find that person. Businesses of all sizes trust ZipRecruiter for their hiring needs. Right now, you can try it absolutely free. There's no reason not to use it. Go to free. That's a pretty good price. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/security now. ZipRecruiter.com/security now. The smartest way to hire. ZipRecruiter.com/security now. We thank them for their support. And we've used them. We thank them for helping us build a great company. All right, Steve Gibson, I'm going to get the remote control out and turn your brightness up a little bit because you need every bit of...
I'm a little dim today.
You need
today.
Every bit of brightness you
a
got today.
A little dim.
We're talking, for those not watching the video, Steve's on a big screen. I feel like it's a Star Trek view screen behind me. And he, you know, we gotta
yes,
give him...
over your left shoulder.
Yeah, we got to give him some brightness. Go ahead. You can talk while I brighten you up.
Ah, well, so anyway, yes, thank you. Our picture of the week... It's actually about a story we will get to in a little bit, this UP and proxy. But I liked it. This was part of the report that described this particular exploit. And what's happened is that this is, you know, fiction meets reality. How many times have those of us who are tech savvy sort of rolled our eyes when the plot of the cyber whatever it is involves the bad guy bouncing around the world and looping around and, you know, like bouncing off of 19 servers, unquote, whatever those are supposed to be, you know, before, you know, making the final connection. And consequently, that's a big, you know, a plot glitch is, oh, there's no way we can track him down because they routed through 19 other locations all over the world. Well, that got a lot easier. And this picture from this report that we'll be covering in a second shows an attacker, location unknown, connecting to a virtual private server that then hops through three so-called proxy routers, which anyone looking at the picture will sort of recognize as, oh, I have one of those on my shelf. And that's exactly the point, is it turns out that something that we have long warned of, and was that episode 358 or something? I have it in the show notes, and we'll get to it a little bit later. We warned our listeners to turn this thing off. Well, it's now being abused widely to turn individual SOHO, you know, small office, home office routers, regular residential consumer routers, into basically sort of the grand central of bad guy traffic. So I thought this was a great picture because it demonstrates that, yes, what once was sort of fanciful and it's like, okay, well, maybe super advanced hackers could pull this off, but, you know, this is not really going to happen in the real world. No, now, I mean, you too can do this from the comfort of, what, I guess, your couch or your mother's basement or wherever you happen to be. So anyway, sort of a fun picture we will get to. And Leo, for the first this actually, I was going to number this zero, except we don't have zero. Our show notes items are not numbered. So, but it actually, believe it or not, is the case. Today, April 17th, I guess as a consequence of the fact that April 15th fell on a Sunday, that must be why.
Yeah, and but, Monday was like Emancipation Day in Washington, D.C. So that would be Tuesday. Yeah.
So, you know, in the U.S., for those who are not in the U.S., our so-called Internal Revenue Service, the IRS, this is our tax filing deadline date for the 2017 calendar year. And one of the headlines I got a kick out of said that the IRS's e-filing system is, wait for it, overtaxed.
That just sounds like a clever headline writer, because what I saw was that the IRS didn't know why it wasn't working.
They don't.
Yeah.
No.
So it may not be overtaxed. It may be something else.
Under attack.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So basically, our U.S. e-filing system, which one would expect to be heavily used, is not been working well all day. And as we know, it is extremely difficult nowadays to keep a system online for which there's any reason for bad guys to want to have not be online. There's so many ways now with DDoS amplification attacks and the ready availability of things that can attack in order to launch these attacks that, I mean, as we've been talking about.
It could be some 15-year-old in Columbus, Ohio, right?
Yes. Yes. It doesn't have to be a nation state mounting an attack against the IRS in the U.S. and probably isn't. It's just somebody who says, hey, you know, this is the time that lots of people are going to be trying to be filing their taxes at the e-filing website. So let's just take those guys offline. And if that's the case, I mean, we don't know. But I guess there was some IRS person was giving testimony in front of Congress. And, you know, that's kind of not a big high profile issue, just some meeting somewhere. And one of the Congress people said, so do you know that the e-filing system is offline right now? And he's like, oh, well, yes, we're looking into that. And we expect it to be back up later today, which apparently they have no idea what's wrong. Oh, and the other
thing is, it's been 8 hours, at least last time I checked.
And it says that it's a planned outage.
No, and so that's not true.
No, I saw a screenshot.
That seems stupid if you plan an outage on tax filing day.
Wouldn't that be bad planning?
Oh, man, I wouldn't put it past them.
It said April 17th, 2018, planned outage. So, which basically means it wasn't planned, but the message was planned to appear and declare that it was planned.
Unbelievable.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
Clearly not planned.
We didn't plan.
Okay. So, we have AMD having last week published the updates for microcode for all of their chips since 2011. So that's dating back to, you know, how everybody's got these code names for their chips. These are the first Bulldozer core products introduced in 2011. So from Bulldozer on, there are now somewhere, which isn't to say that it's actually in anyone's AMD chips yet, but supposedly, those patches are available. They were supposed to be released last Tuesday for the Windows 10 version 1709, you know, the Fall Creators Update, which is where we still are. The most recent version, the most recent official version of Windows 10. And do you have news, Leo? Because I know you and Paul and Mary Jo were talking last Wednesday about when the spring update was, or whatever it was going to be called.
So
spring
one
creators
thing,
update?
First of all, it doesn't have a name. It's 1803.
Okay.
The other thing is that Paul and Mary Jo said, you know, no one at Microsoft said it was going to be Patch Tuesday. Everybody just assumed it was going to be Patch Tuesday. So Microsoft never said it's coming out then. So they're not late. although they did say there is
no promise made.
Yeah, there was a delay. Its internal codename is Redstone 4, and according to Paul, the last time I saw, they've put out a new RTM. What they don't like to call it RTM, but they put out a new RTM for it.
A hopeful RTM.
Yeah, hopeful RTM, and so it'll be soon.
Okay. Well, so
it'll be
aside from that, it was supposed to be the case that last Tuesday's Patch Tuesday existing version of Windows 10, which is 1709,
right,
that added the mitigations and the Spectre variant 2 for the AMD chips, which is to say they had provided those to Microsoft. And just as Microsoft has incorporated the Intel microcode patches into an earlier release of Windows. That was supposed to have been done for AMD. Now, I have a laptop with, and I forgot what it was now. It's an AMD 64-something 5000, M4 5000. I don't remember now what it was. But I think it was only like 2013, so I would have expected it to be swept up in that. I did the update. I checked, and it's not showing this as fixed. However, there are developer guidelines now that have also been published, which enumerate the changes in the chips, the CPU ID bits, which can be queried to determine whether it's got the updated functions. So the point of all this is that as probably tomorrow, I will, as I have been recently, return to Inspector and add support for these new functions, which are now documented in the developer docs, which will allow my Inspector app to tell users whether their chip has been updated, and presumably Microsoft won't update the firmware unless they're also updating the Windows OS to support it. So anyway, I guess it was last week that we talked about the final for Intel, on the Intel side, the final list of CPU IDs which had Intel's updates, and controversially those that did not. And I did then rev Inspector to release 8, where it is now, with knowledge of that. So there's another line in the little summary screen at the top of Inspector telling you whether microcode updates are available, which is different from whether they are actually in effect for your chip. So that allows you to see whether there's hope if you're on the Intel side. And I haven't yet found the same thing from AMD. I'll see whether they've got by CPU ID a list of which ones do and don't have those available. What I do have now is the ability to determine whether it's actually in place or not in the hardware. So I plan to be updating Inspector. It would probably be release 9 to incorporate that additional information. But so for what it's worth, AMD's finished that. They did it all at once. It's supposed to be from Bulldozer on, which was 2011. So Microsoft will probably be incorporating those. Microsoft has said they did, although I haven't seen it. So hopefully I'll get some tweets from people saying, yeah, ever since last Tuesday, Inspector has been saying that my system is all patched against, you know, the Spectre variant, although I haven't seen that. I haven't looked actually since. So I will. But remember, separate from this, we still have the Ryzen Fall, Master Key, Fallout, and Chimera vulnerabilities, which came to light last month. Those are considered less dangerous and not as big a problem, but they are, you know, those are yet to be dealt with by AMD, who has at least acknowledged them and said that they would be getting to it. So progress. And hopefully on the Windows side, those using systems that are no older than about 7 years, and who are using a recent enough version of Windows that Microsoft will patch them, will be able to get some those microcode updates. So yay. We've been tracking, because it's sort of interesting, for the last few podcasts, the fate of Telegram in Russia. As we know, Russia said, we're not going to allow any encryption that we cannot decrypt. Telegram said, sorry, we're not giving you the keys to the kingdom. Russia went through several rounds of various court actions in order to make this compulsory. Telegram stood their ground, said, sorry, nope. And so Russia then, late last week, got the final machinations finished to require that Telegram get blocked. That is Telegram's domains. Apparently, in an effort to, and I guess it's sort of, they were playing cutesy because, I mean, this is a losing battle on Telegram's part. Telegram moved a bunch of their IPv4 IP addresses deliberately into net blocks being used by Amazon's AWS and Google's cloud platforms. As a consequence, Russia, using a rather blunt instrument, blocked 15.8 million IPs.
Oh, man.
On those Amazon and Google cloud platforms.
Oh, Lord.
Yes, and I have them in the show notes. It is a massive block. So, you know, in network terminology, if you have a network with a /16, that says that the high 2 bytes is the network, and then the low 2 bytes are typically .0.0, meaning that all addresses with any of the lower 2 bytes are part of this block. Well, this isn't quite that bad. It's a /15, but there's 3 /15s and a /14, meaning that basically 4 different networks, each one being specified by 2 bits plus one, the highest order bit of the third byte, have all been blacklisted. That is just blacked out. So that ends up being 15.8 million IPs, which unfortunately, because many, many, many other Amazon and Google services were occupying this huge region of IPv4 space, all kinds of Russian retailers and non-Telegram services, credit card processing, it just created a huge, and is still a huge upheaval. There's been a tremendous, this happened yesterday. And so it's been a tremendous problem in Russia because they were just going to say, no, we're not fooling around here. We're blocking all of this. So in addition, Russia's telecommunications regulator asked Apple and Google to pull Telegram from their app stores. So that iOS and Android, they said, pull the apps. They also requested the side loading site APK Mirror to cease serving Telegram, which would probably be the first alternative for Android users should Google comply, as I would imagine they would, and pull Telegram from the Play Store if they can do so for Russia's view of the Play Store. And also the telecommunications regulator for Russia also urged VPN providers to prevent Telegram messages from getting through. So, you know, right now there's a mess over there. I don't know what Telegram's position will be. I mean, they ought to just give up. I mean, they should have seen the writing on the wall. There was some comment that I encountered where Telegram said, well, they're considering doing a peer-to-peer messaging system, but no time has been set for that happening. And the New York Times, in their reporting, noted that the ban on Telegram would put the Kremlin in a slightly awkward position because many inside the government, including those in President Vladimir Putin's press office, use Telegram themselves. So Russia's foreign ministry has announced its intention to move over to the Viber messaging app. Viber claims that it is completely encrypted as well, but presumably not so much. Or, I don't know, maybe we'll go through the same dance again. But, you know, this is, it's been interesting to watch this. As we know, this happened with Telegram in China, where Telegram is now blocked in China. Now it's happened in Russia. And, you know, it's, the problem is that someone trying to run a service in direct opposition to the government that controls telecommunications within that space, they're going to lose that battle. So it's, you know, I guess I'm somewhat at a loss to understand what Telegram thought they were doing, except just, you know, it's not expensive for them to fight Russia. So I guess they've decided, well, we'd rather fight than just go quietly. So fine. Still, their Telegram is gone from Russia, essentially. Not unsurprisingly. And we've also been following from the start what has been called Drupalgeddon 2. Remember that Drupalgeddon 1 was a very bad SQL Server exposure that Drupal suffered years ago. Now we've got essentially what is regarded as a 25 out of 25 in the NIST's ranking. So the highest level of critical rating. This is remember that they gave a 1 week notification, the Drupal team did, 1 week notification that on a Wednesday they were going to be making public the details of patches for both the 7 and the 8 series, as well as the 6 series of Drupal, even though it had long since stopped being maintained because there were still some version 6s online, and this was that bad. So the problem with patching is, especially with something like Drupal, where it's possible to analyze it and figure out what was done, is that the next day, the day after, on Thursday, Checkpoint Research came out with it wasn't like any great explosion of surprise. They said, okay, here's what happened. Here's what was done. Since it was patched, it was in the public, it was available to everyone. And so that produced full details. Immediately afterwards, GitHub began hosting proof of concept demonstrations. And now many security outlets are reporting that Drupal sites are 1,000% predictably under attack. So we have a remote code execution, an RCE, for unpatched Drupal 6, 7, and 8. So, essentially, if you've got a server running Drupal and you haven't patched it, it's going to get found and it's going to get taken over. Probably, you'll notice that it starts running really slowly because what people want to do these days is run cryptocurrency mining on a strong internet-connected machine. So if you start noticing things start going slow, you need to deal with it. What we know now is that Drupal had insufficient input sanitation on Form API, so-called FAPI Ajax requests. And as a result, an attacker was able to inject a malicious payload into the internal forms structure, which would have caused Drupal to execute it without any sort of user authentication. And so by exploiting this vulnerability, an attacker would have been able, and can is able, if you haven't patched 6, 7, or 8 in the last couple weeks, to carry out a full site takeover of anyone using Drupal. So on last Friday, the day after this Thursday announcement that this is happening, in what they considered a public service announcement, and this, of course, was Friday the 13th, which really was for these guys, they said this Drupal published this public service announcement is a follow-up to, and then they've got the number of a previous release, Drupal Core RCE, Remote Code Execution. This is not an announcement of a new vulnerability. If you have not updated your site as described in, and then again, the original announcement, you should assume, get this, this is Drupal saying, you should assume your site has been targeted and follow directions for remediation as described below. The security team is now aware, Drupal writes, of automated attacks attempting to compromise Drupal 7 and 8 websites using the vulnerability reported in, and again, this is SA Core 2018-002. Due to this, the security team is increasing the security risk score of that issue to 24 out of 25. I don't remember what it was, but obviously a little lower than that still, like you get right at the ceiling. Sites not patched by Wednesday, 2018-4-11, so that was the Wednesday a week before, may be compromised. This is the date when evidence emerged of automated attack attempts. That is the same day the patch was announced. It is possible targeted attacks occurred before. Simply updating Drupal will not remove backdoors or fix compromised sites. If you find, they write, that your site is already patched, but I had to do a double take on this one. If you find that your site is already patched, but you didn't do it, that can be a symptom that the site has been compromised, meaning that the attackers are closing the back door behind them after they already get in to keep anybody else from coming in and pushing them out. Some attacks in the past have applied the patch as a way to guarantee, Drupal writes, that only the attacker is in control of the site. So it's hard for me to imagine that somebody listening to this wouldn't have also been listening to both of our previous two podcasts where the urgency of this was made very clear, even when it was still a week away from being known. But somebody would have been very ready. So what they are reporting is that it looks like these automated attacks are closing the back door behind them, patching this so that they alone are there. Therefore, if your site appears to be patched and you didn't do it, that's additional reason to worry. And I don't know for a fact that they're installing cryptocurrency mining, but that's what people are doing these days. So if you suddenly see that your CPU utilization has jumped up, that's a good reason to suspect also that this has happened. So, this unfortunately is now the model for vulnerabilities being discovered on the internet. It was discovered. They got the patches ready. They pre-announced to everyone, get ready for a patch for which we expect to have exploits immediately follow. That happened. The exploits happened. Now they're underway and sites are being taken over. So I hope if by any chance you are a Security Now listener and you skipped a couple weeks of announcements and you somehow didn't already know that your Drupal site needs to get patched, don't wait any longer.
And assume you've been hacked.
And yes, you really do. At this point, it's just not, it's not difficult to find you, to check your version, and to insert an exploit if the back door hasn't been closed by somebody already beating somebody else in. Yikes. So I performed the following test just now, this morning, in preparing these notes, and it all works. Firefox has begun bringing up support for TLS version 1.3, but not enabling it by default. This is a very cool thing for any Firefox user. SSLLabs.com is Ivan Ristic's very cool SSL, now TLS, testing facility. We normally talk of it in terms of testing sites, that is testing, you know, like grc.com, google.com, apple.com, whatever, amazon.com. But the second item on Ivan's testing menu is check your browser. You can also use ssllabs.com as an individual to check the strength of the crypto that your browser is using. When you do it with Chrome, you will find it's already supporting TLS version 1.3. When you do it with Firefox, you will find TLS version 1.2. So that, again, that's ssllabs.com, and then you choose test your browser over on the upper right, the second item down. So with Firefox, and this, I updated my Firefox. I'm at 59.0.2, which is the latest. And that was on a Windows 10 machine. You'll see that your browser supports version 1.2. Go to about:config, you know, put about:config in the URL bar of Firefox, and you know, hit enter. That'll give you this huge list of things you can tweak. In the search area, put in you can just put in version.max. That'll weed it right down. I think I had two items in there when I had version.max, and you'll see that it is likely set to 3. Set it to 4. That won't hurt anything. Set it to 4. You don't need to restart Firefox. And if you had opened another tab, if you just opened another tab to do about:config, go back to the SSL Labs tab, refresh that, and you will now be greeted with the fact that your browser is running TLS version 1.3. So just changing under about:config and then search for version.max. The whole thing is security.tls.version.max. Change the 3 to a 4, and your Firefox will now be persistently and from then on operating with the very latest version of the transport layer security, TLS version 1.3. And Leo, I see that we're about 40 minutes in. I'm going to sip some coffee, and then we will continue.
Your timing is excellent, my friend. Our show today brought to you by Rocket Mortgage. If you're ready to buy a home or refinance your current home, you might want to check out Quicken Loans, the best lender in the country, number one in customer satisfaction, 8 years running, according to J.D. Power. But it's not just that. It's also really a technologically savvy company. Dan and his team put together Quicken Loans some years ago. Actually, it was originally called Rock Capital, and then they were bought by Intuit, which renamed them Quicken Loans. And Dan thought after a few years, no, we can do this better, bought it back, but didn't bother changing the name. So that's why it's called Quicken Loans. It has nothing to do with Intuit or Quicken. But I think in a way they've gotten back to their roots because their new mortgage solution is named, remember, they used to be Rock Capital, Rocket Mortgage. It's perfect, too, because it's an entirely online mortgage approval process. Dan's a geek, and he wants to do the high-tech thing. And he realized that the mortgage, you know, the home loan market, borrowing market, was just really mired in the Dickensian era, you know, and they said, we can do a better job. No more going to a bank hat in hand, no more filling in a long application or faxing materials back to the bank over a period of weeks. No, you can do it all, the entire process online in just a few minutes. You can check it out at rocketmortgage.com/security now. It begins with an application that couldn't be simpler. You already know the answers to everything they're going to ask. Then, because they have relationships with all the financial institutions, all you have to do is say, okay, go ahead, get my information. I'm not going to go to the attic. You get it. They get it. They crunch the numbers based on income, assets, and credit. They determine which loans you qualify for, often with really surprisingly great rates. I mean, wow, you choose the rate, you choose the term, 15 years, 30 years, whatever. You also choose the down payment. And then they approve you. And it's that simple. You'll apply simply, you'll understand everything that's going on fully, and then you'll mortgage confidently at Rocket Mortgage. And it can happen so fast. You could go into an open house, say, let's buy this, and before you leave, say, we're approved. It's that easy. Do it on your phone. Rocket, in fact, if you want to speed it up even faster, go there now, sign up, create the account, and you'll be ready. RocketMortgage.com/security now. To get started, sign up. Then go look at houses. Or maybe you're refinancing. Now's a good time. Interest rates are certainly going up. RocketMortgage.com/security now. They're an equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states. NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030. RocketMortgage.com/security now. We thank Rocket Mortgage and Quicken Loans for making this show possible. And now back to Steve Gibson.
The recaffeinated Steve Gibson.
Nicely caffeinated. He's nicely caffeinated.
So Akamai is calling this UPN proxy. And of course, we recognize the first four letters, UPNP. I'm speechless. Years ago, we talked about this. And we were stunned that UPnP, the Universal Plug and Play, aka Universal Plug and Pray protocol, which was only ever intended to be a function or a feature on the inside, on the LAN side of consumer routers. And even then, it was a worrisome idea. This was Microsoft's solution, essentially, for Xbox to be able to make itself available behind a NAT router. The idea being that it was a zero configuration solution. Anytime you hear the words zero configuration, that's when you should start worrying, because if nobody has to configure nothing, then the bad guys don't either. And so the idea was that with no configuration, for example, an Xbox behind, on your home network would be able to find the router, talk to the router. Doesn't need any router admin login passwords or anything. It's just able to say, "Hi there, I'd like an outside line, please." And the router says, "Oh, that's why I'm here," and opens up a port or multiple ports, however many the Xbox wants. I mean, essentially, Universal Plug and Play is an invisible, unprotected, insecure, zero authentication protocol that completely defeats the router's NAT firewall. The beauty of NAT being that only outbound connections are allowed, and incoming traffic is only allowed back in if it matches something that first went out. It's a perfect firewalling solution, which Universal Plug and Play completely subverts. Okay, so it was bad enough, right, when the Universal Plug and Play service was exposed on the LAN. Bad enough. as we covered years ago on Security Now, episode 389, it came to our attention that many routers had not bothered to restrict it to the LAN and also had it available on the WAN, which, I mean, there are no words. It's unbelievably insane. So it was so bad that I dropped everything I was doing at the time and added a new test to GRC's Shields Up, which, Leo, you'll remember at the time that this was, I called it GRC's Instant UPnP Exposure Test. And I want to remind everyone about it so that everyone can make sure that it's still like that anything that they've done since then hasn't caused this to be reopened for them, because there are many routers that currently are still doing this today. So just go to grc.com under services. I think it's the second item in our top level menu under services. You'll find Shields Up, the first thing on that submenu. Select that, say okay, and there's a big orange box that I haven't touched in all these years. Click that, and in a few seconds, you will be able to confirm, with everything coming up hopefully green, that your router, wherever you are, is not making universal plug-and-play service available to the internet.
I can't believe that after all these years, we still have to tell people that.
Leo, that when you do the test, and you're doing it right now, when you do it, it will show you the count. This morning, it was 53,922 open UPnP ports found.
Wow.
So
where is that? Where is that number?
So,
is it?
So click that big orange thing.
Yeah.
Click that, and now is running the test for you. And now it ran the test for you.
Good news.
And you're green.
Look at that.
And let's see. So what is it?
That's a lot of open routers. 53,922.
Okay, same number I had this morning. Yep. So
that's good
since
news.
Then, that's good news. Let's hope that it doesn't increment in the next 10 minutes while the listeners to this live podcast are checking theirs to see what's going on. And I'm noticing an increase in traffic at GRC, so I know people are listening to it and running the test right now. Okay, so here's what's happening. Because there are so many, an unbelievable number of routers exposed, Akamai did a test using their network resources. They have detected more than 4.8 million routers that expose various UPnP services through their WAN interface. That number should be zero. Zero. There is, I mean, it's an absolute mistake for, it's amazing to me that this is still happening. And Leo, there is their white paper that I've linked to in the show notes has toward the end a list of routers which are today, as a consumer benefit, they posted a bunch of like the list of routers they have identified which are still doing this. There are a bunch of ASUS routers, unfortunately, and my favorite Ubiquiti routers, not the one that we've chosen, but some of the wireless routers still have this available. So if you page down through that PDF, Leo, that you've got on screen right now, you should find, I think toward the end, is their list. They fully document this for anybody who's interested, and then they show the various routers which they have identified which are exposed. So the point is that when routers do this, you can normally disable it. You can normally turn off, and it should never be on. It shouldn't even be an option. But hopefully you can turn off universal plug and play on the WAN interface. It there is no valid reason for having that exposed. So for some reason, a lot of ASUS routers do offer it. Huh. Frighteningly.
Yeah, sometimes you need it for outbound traffic. Famously, this was created for the Xbox by Microsoft. That's who made this, so that the Xbox could connect to could create an Xbox server, and you could play games with people, and they could have inbound access. But that's not WAN access. That's a very different thing.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. So anyway, I just wanted to make sure. So what's happened is, because there are millions of Soho routers with UPnP services exposed, and because universal plug and play can be used to create a NAT mapping, not only are you able to map from an inside IP and port to an outside IP and port, you can arbitrarily, basically it's known as packet rewriting. You rewrite the destination IP of incoming packets. Normally they would be rewritten to an IP destination inside the LAN. So for example, that's where the Xbox would be. And so we would say, packets coming into this port on this router get rewritten to 192.168.1. whatever the Xbox is. You can, however, establish packet destination IP rerouting to any IP you want. What's happening is these routers are being used to bounce incoming traffic back out. In other words, with enough of these routers, it's possible for a bad guy to do exactly what we see in all of the fictional cyber attack scenarios, where traffic is routed around the globe five or six times, bouncing off of, you know, proxy servers. Well, that's what this turns Soho routers into: proxies, which are able to be used trivially to route public traffic from one UPnP router to another, to another, to another, to another, in order to hide the origin of the traffic. And once there's nothing to prevent multiple bad guys from all doing this simultaneously on any given user's router, meaning that your router with UPnP exposed becomes a little Grand Central Station of malicious traffic bouncing off of your WAN interface in order to obscure and hide whatever these bad guys are doing. And of course, the problem is when this gets traced back, it gets traced back to you, to your IP or the one you had at the time. So it's better not to have to explain to the authorities that, you know, you weren't the one who was originating this traffic. Just better to have this shut down and not have an open router. So use GRC's quick universal plug and play test to verify that no response is coming from the UPnP service port on your WAN interface. It takes 5 seconds to do it, and know that you're okay. And if you're not okay, then absolutely arrange, you know, I mean, change routers, update your firmware, get, you know, turn off universal plug and play on the WAN interface if that's an option. And boy, you certainly have my endorsement in scolding any router manufacturer. I don't know what ASUS is thinking, but as I recall from the Akamai document, there's like a huge block of ASUS router models that have universal plug and play exposed. So that can't be a mistake. That's a policy decision, and which I just, that makes me scratch my head. In January of this year, when the Meltdown and Spectre attacks became known, Microsoft gave us the first mitigations to those attacks that they were able to in the January updates for Windows. And somewhat puzzling at the time, and certainly controversial, was their decision to announce, well, the announcement of their decision and the decision that they would no longer update Windows unless a specific registry key was present, which their AV solutions and other AV solutions could create in order to assert that they were not going to crash people's machines, cause blue screens, and so forth. So, and I remember, you know, you and I, Leah, were like, what? You know, we're just kind of scratching our heads, and I heard you talking
to... It's kind of a funky way to do it.
It's like weird. Yeah.
Yeah.
And normally, because you had Windows, Defender or Security Essentials or something, you were kind of probably going to be okay. But there were instances where Windows 7 might not have had something enabled, and suddenly Windows updates would stop and you wouldn't get them anymore ever, so we believed. Well, turns out that there was a lot of back pressure on this policy, and Microsoft learned that that had not been such a good idea. So quietly, the March update for Windows 10 happened even with that key was missing. And last week, this April's updates happened even if that key was not present for Windows 7 and 8.1. In other words, that's no longer true now. Windows 10 and 7 and 8.1 are all now ignoring the key, whether it's present or not, and going ahead and doing updates. Microsoft, of course, now has to kind of backpedal and explain what. And so now they're saying, well, we've now been able to verify that no one's AV is actually causing a problem, or everyone's AV is now no longer causing a problem, or some nonsense. Anyway, basically, this is gone, and I just sort of wanted to correct, or I wanted to update everybody with where we stood and the fact that this was now happily a non-issue, that everybody, no matter what version of Windows you're using, whether you've got a registered AV or not, you are getting Windows security updates. Oh, and Microsoft said in their notice that this change, in other words, undoing that what we did in January, this change has been made to protect user data. Yeah. Okay. Right. Yeah. Okay. So, this is a little bit controversial in my mind. Google has announced that starting with Chrome 70, which is slated for still a ways away, toward the end of October 2018, that their Chrome browser is going to begin deliberately ignoring the requested expiration time on cookies delivered to the browser over HTTP. Now, as opposed to HTTPS. In other words, this is another pushback by Chrome using their market dominance and their position to make things more troublesome for non-HTTPS, non-TLS connected websites. So starting with Chrome 70, any website trying to present a persistent cookie, like a cookie with an expiration date set way in the future, will have it capped at 1 year. And their longer-term plan is over time to proactively reduce HTTP cookie life down to as little as a few days. So I guess I have mixed feelings. This is clever because it's going to create some inconvenience for sites trying to create statically persistent session cookies, so that you can stay logged on without having to re-authenticate and re-log on. Typically, that's done with a cookie, and most sites just say, "Oh, you know, you're logged on until you log off," or leave it at that. They do so by setting an expiration far in the future. Now, the reason I have sort of mixed feelings is that, you know, Chrome is also deliberately breaking the HTTP standard. I mean, they're just saying they're going to deliberately ignore and violate a longstanding standard. So I guess I understand it, but it makes me feel a little queasy. We all remember the danger of HTTP cookies, because that's what FireSheep was, you know, made very famous back in the day when it was easy to, like when Facebook and you know, Snapchat and all the various services were not yet using HTTPS all the time. You would typically use that briefly to log in to protect your username and password, but then somewhat paradoxically, they would drop you back down to HTTP, but your cookie was there so that anybody sniffing the traffic could grab the cookie and immediately jump online impersonating you, essentially, acquire your logged in session for their own. So anyway, I wanted to explain this to everybody, to tell our audience that this is something that Chrome has decided to do, probably for the best, but still annoying that they're going to be ignoring this standard. I don't know what kind of time frame they expect for shortening this to a few days. It certainly will upset people who, for whatever reason, want to stay with HTTP, want to be able to have persistent sessions with HTTP issued cookies. They will just won't be able to do that in the future for more than a couple of days, eventually, apparently. So it'll be interesting to see how this evolves. A German security firm, SRL, Security Research Labs, did some careful looking at a large number of Android mobile devices, primarily smartphones, and discovered that OEMs of Android phones were deliberately misrepresenting the completeness of patches for their devices. In Android, you're able to look at the so-called security patch level as a certain date. It's presented as a date. And the clear statement that is making is that your phone patched up to this date it incorporates all of the known problems earlier than that. Well, it turns out it's not even close to being true. In an interview with Wired magazine, the researchers at SRL, at Security Research Labs, said, quote, "Sometimes these guys just change the date without installing any patches." They said, probably for Mark. I know. I know. Probably for marketing reasons, they just set the patch level to an almost arbitrary date, whatever looks best.
Oh, that's terrible. Yesterday. We fixed it yesterday.
Yeah, don't worry. Yesterday we're updated.
That's got to be some smooth, crappy phones, though. I can't imagine.
Okay, so here it is. They enumerate them, and in the if you follow the link, Leo, in the notes, you can get the detail because they have a nice little red colored chart. But 0 to 1 missing patches was Google, Sony, Samsung, and Wico Mobile.
Well, I wish they'd say whether it's 0 or 1. That's kind of annoying.
I know.
There's a big difference between 0 and 1.
Yeah. On the other hand,
I got to think Google is 0, right?
Yes. On the other hand, HTC, Huawei, LG, and Motorola are 3 to 4.
Yeah, that's not good.
No. And that is to say, they're claiming they are current, yet they are not. 3 to 4 missing security patches later than the date they said they are current to.
Yeah.
And then the worst at 4+ was people I've never heard of, TCL and ZTE.
Chinese companies, both. In fact, yes. All of them, I don't know about Alps, but TCL, Oppo, and ZTE are all 3 Chinese companies.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So, wow. And I don't know how to
Huh?
What were you going to say?
I just said, wow.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And also OnePlus, Nokia, and is it pronounced Xiaomi?
Xiaomi. Another Chinese company. Another Chinese
Xiaomi.
Company.
I've heard of
big,
them. Sure.
Big Chinese, maybe the number Xiaomi. One phone maker in China. Yeah.
So Xiaomi, OnePlus, and Nokia, those are 1 to 3 missing patches,
yeah.
Meaning none of them had 0. They were all missing at least 1. Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
So,
that's ridiculous.
Yes. And they said specifically the above, that is that table I was reading from, focused on security patches for critical and high severity vulnerabilities that were released in 2017, still missing from their phones.
You know, it's sad. Motorola's on here. It used to be a Google company, but now it's owned by Lenovo. And I have to think that maybe because it's owned by a Chinese company, it too is not getting updated.
Yeah. 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 Now, there is some good news. We've discussed previously that Google is aware of this problem. That is, you know, because they're the main driver of this, they have a project underway called Treble, which is re-architecting Android to disentangle the OEM level customizations from the OS code, because right now it's necessary, essentially all of this stuff has to pass through the OEMs and like be sort of backported into the stuff, you know, into the OEM's own code blob, which then needs to be pushed out for their phones. So, and it's unclear if it's just lack of concern. Essentially, you know, what we believe is that OEMs are unhappy because all they want to do is sell hardware. They want to sell, you know, DVD players and, you know, just consumer electronics and just like sell them and forget them. They don't. And so they're complaining about the burden of this constant updating patching of the devices they've sold, which consumes too much of their resources because as it is structured today, it's involved to get these things patched. So Google's Treble project is recognized in recognition of this serious, significant overhead, is restructuring Android to separate the OEM junk from more of the OS stuff, which will reduce the burden on the OEM for these kinds of ongoing fixes. So Google's responding, and we can hope that as we move forward, we're going to get this whole process sped up some. Two bits of miscellany that I'm going to continue. The first is, Leo, Lost in Space.
Okay.
Did you see it?
I only watched the first episode.
Okay.
And I have mixed feelings about it. I downloaded the whole thing for our trip, so it's on my iPad. They spent a long time getting that girl out of that ice in the first episode. That just kind of went on and on and on. But I liked it.
Yep.
I didn't hate it.
Yep.
What did you think?
So I feel like it's
a mixed bag. It's not great.
Lori and I agree. Lori and I watched all 10.
Wow.
So we did Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Holy cow.
I've seen the whole first 10 episodes. I hope there's more.
You want to see more. Okay.
I would rather watch it than House of Cards, and that got
pretty good. Yeah.
3 seasons?
Yeah.
No, it was great. I will say, and this is not a spoiler, I'm never going to spoil anything, but boy, Dr. Smith is annoying.
Yeah. He was kind of annoying in the original.
Yes, he was like a fly in the ointment.
But at least he was he had something going for him in that one. This one, they've really made Smith kind of not so good.
Yeah, Parker Posey we talked about. Mm-hmm. And yikes. So be prepared to be annoyed. On the other hand, I mean, I was thinking about it. It's engaging that she, Dr. Smith, is so annoying.
Right.
I mean, you just keep wanting her something to fall on her, but nothing does. But really cool robot, neat robot, and an interesting backstory there. We learn about, you know, I mean, anyway, I'll just say.
I think people who dislike it the most are people who are real fans of the original, because it's nothing like the original.
No, and I think that's probably good.
Yeah,
because
it was a cartoon.
You know, waving your arms around, danger, Will Robinson, danger, and you know, and being attacked by salad monsters.
Yeah.
It just doesn't really.
Yeah.
That's not going to do it. But anyway, I just wanted to follow up on that. We liked it, and
it was entertaining.
I hope we get another season of it.
Mixed bag.
Yes, and it won't surprise anybody that you know there will probably be another season. So without giving any spoilers, I'm sure Netflix is hoping for more, and I am. I did get, as I mentioned at the top of the show, a nice note that I wanted to share. And I didn't know what overcoming SSE was. This is Mike in Dundas, Ontario, on the 15th of April. So that's two days ago on Sunday. He said, "Hi, Steve and Leo," addressing it to both of us. He said, "I've been waiting a long time to drop you guys a note. I decided the trigger for my correspondence was to be a miraculous save using SpinRite. That's why I titled this document Overcoming SpinRite Story Envy."
Ah, SSE.
So that's SSE, SpinRite Story Envy. He says, "I, like many, many others, have heard on the – I have heard on this podcast – I like many, many others whom I have heard on this podcast. I purchased," he wrote, "a copy of SpinRite as a thank you for the invaluable service you both provide." He says, "I've been listening to Leo for quite some time from very early when he spent a lot of time in Toronto." And of course, you and I were
did too.
There.
That's right. Yeah.
Yes, it was in Toronto that you proposed this podcast to me, in fact.
I got on my hands and knees and proposed to Steve.
So he says, "Thought I would give this new Security Now podcast a listen." He says, "You had me from the very beginning. Oh. I guess I am a snotter," he says, S-N-0.
He likes his acronyms.
E-R. Yeah. "A Security Now zero dayer."
Oh, I like it. Oh, a snotter. Yes.
S-N-O-D, a snotter.
I'm using that. Hello to all you snotters.
That's right. He says, "However, I've finally given up waiting for a drive to have trouble because I don't think it will ever happen to me personally." He says, "I practice Steve's hard drive hygiene."
Exactly.
Okay. He arranged not to do SHDH, which was hard drive hygiene protocol, to the point where I too have a dedicated SpinRite machine and my daughter uses SpinRite as a verb. So he says, "Just wanted to say thanks and that you guys are the best."
Wow.
Nice so story. Mike, thanks for sharing. Leo, let's take our last break and then we will wrap up our week.
Indeed. And this is a good one for anybody who wants more security when they buy things online from Capital One. Security Now brought to you by Eno. Eno has a feature that I use all the time. Stop sharing your real credit card number when you shop online, start using Eno's virtual numbers. Whenever I see a credit card field, I'm in my browser and I'm going to buy something, Eno pops up and says, "Hi, I would be glad to make a virtual number for this site with a full credit card number, an expiration date that's always, interestingly, 5 years from now, and one of those security numbers." Automatically fills it in. Now, that number is now associated with that merchant and that merchant only. That's it. Of course, the merchant gets money from your credit card, your Capital One card, but they don't get your credit card number. They don't get any information about you. Your privacy is protected. You get access to all the wonderful things the internet has to offer without giving up your credit card number when you're online. And there's some real valuable reasons for this. If ever a merchant's compromised, and you hear about this all the time, it just happened with Panera Bread, right? You just delete the virtual number. It's kind of like those application-specific passwords. You can just revoke it. No good, no problem. It can't be used anymore. If your card is lost or stolen, and this is really good, there's that reset moment. We actually talked to the senior VP of digital e-commerce at Capital One, Tom Poole. And I said to him, Tom, one of the reasons I love this is that people know this who watch the show, I've revealed my credit card number on shows in the past. Like I'm in the middle of paying something and it comes up on the screen, which means I now have a minute to immediately cancel that credit card number. But then I got the pain in the butt for the next few days of figuring out all the different services that credit card number is tied to and giving them a new number. Tom calls it the reset moment.
When we looked at this and realized that the most pressing problems our customers were facing was this giant reset moment, this whether the card expires or it's lost or stolen or it's compromised online, this moment when suddenly out of the blue you were being asked to spend a couple hours updating your numbers on every single site. It's terrible, and yeah. People live in fear of it, so much so that they actually steer their shopping toward a handful of sites that they trust and avoid trialing new experiences and new products precisely because they're afraid that it's a game of Russian roulette. If they put their number at one more site, that might be the site that triggers the event that is the real pain in the neck for everybody.
No more reset moment with Capital One's virtual numbers. Even if your main number is lost or stolen, those virtual numbers continue to work as long as you want them to, up to 5 years. That's why they give you a 5-year expiration date. I've used it now for all the online merchants I use. That it has an additional advantage. Each one has a unique number. I just love it. You can shop safer without all the hassle. If you have an existing Capital One credit card, good news. Just download and install the browser extension. It's on the Chrome Web Store. I use Chrome. I'm sure you do. Every time I surf and I need a credit card number, it's there. And sometimes, you get sites for some reason that don't automatically fill in the forms. It's really nice. You can just drag the number and the expiration, everything right off of there. You don't have to copy paste. Just drag it right off the Eno page right up there in the corner. I love Eno. Eno's got your back. Virtual numbers, Capital One. For more information, go to CapitalOne.com/ENO. That's Eno. It's one backwards. I didn't even know that. Eno is one backward. Capital, CIPITAL. For a long time, I was spelling it with an O. I don't know why. CapitalOne.com/Eno/virtual numbers. CapitalOne.com/Eno/virtual numbers really is the right way to do this. And it's the easiest way to do it because of that Chrome extension. It's a snap. You don't have to do any extra effort. You just get that virtual number. Capital One. .com/Eno/virtual numbers. We thank them for their support of Security Now and supporting our online security. The IRS site apparently is back up, so you can file. But, I wanted to pass along a note from another one of our sponsors, TurboTax. I did my e-filing through TurboTax. If you e-file through TurboTax, even if those servers are down, they hold it, and the minute the servers come back up, they feed it to the IRS. So if you file during this down period via TurboTax, don't worry. Your tax return will be filed, right away. So good news. They figured it out.
In that case, it's sort of functioning as a cash. So they could
call cash it, basically.
Turbo cash.
Yes. Yeah. You do, by the way, if you do e-file, get your refund faster, almost instantly. Just a little note if you want your refund fast.
So, okay. we've known for about 5 years that the original secure random function, which was provided by JavaScript, was not random or not as random as we hoped. We have known for 5 years, since about 2013, maybe even 2012, that it actually only provided about 48 bits of entropy. So there was a scramble around. We covered this at the time on the podcast, a scramble around to improve the JavaScript library. There was a...
Is it Java or JavaScript?
JavaScript.
Script, okay.
Yes. And so the concern is that there were, at the time, browser-based Bitcoin wallets and also some wallet apps that were using some early JavaScript libraries, even if they were standalone, non-browser based. So essentially what has been found by researchers is that those early web browsers JavaScript, which offered the so-called secure random function, were only providing about 48 bits of true entropy. We want to have like 256, right? 48, I mean, that's still a lot, because 32, after all, is 4.3 billion. But several things have happened in the meantime that have sort of created a trifecta. We've got, first, an inherently low entropy private key, because the secure random generates both the Bitcoin address and the private key used to protect your access to it. So an inherently low entropy private key. Second, in the last 5 years, a huge increase in brute force processing power, which is to say brute force cracking power, driven by all of the GPU and ASIC design for hashing fast, and then the significant increase in Bitcoin valuation, which has moved Bitcoin from I really don't care if I even know where my wallet is, to, oh shoot, where did I put that? Or what was my password? I know you can relate to that, Leo. So
absolutely.
I had the ooh shoot moment.
Yeah.
So what we have is means, motive, and opportunity.
Yes.
For there to be a renewed interest in attacking Bitcoin resources, which are not as secure as they really should have been then, but since then, it's gotten easier to attack them, and there's much more motivation to attack them. And as we've learned, the protection that they have is much weaker than was believed. So for what it's worth, the researchers who are looking at this have said, if you have had your Bitcoin for a long time, if you may have generated it back in the day, in the early days when it was sort of just didn't matter and you were screwing around and you thought, oh, what the heck? And you used a web browser a browser-based wallet. Even if you've since subsequently moved to something much more secure, the point is the original entropy being low means that there are now, and researchers know this, there are people working on cracking older Bitcoin addresses and their private keys. So if you have a substantial sum in a Bitcoin wallet, which you have had for a long time and whose entropy, as I've just been explaining, you have reason to distrust, then it is probably worth creating a new Bitcoin address and transferring your balance from the old one to the new one and move into one with guaranteed known high entropy. So I just sort of wanted to pass that on as a public announcement. I know exactly where mine was synthesized when I first talked about it. It was a Windows-based wallet on a version of Windows with a known cryptographically secure source of entropy. So I have every reason to believe I'm okay. But if those multiple things fit you, you had it for a long time, it may have come from a JavaScript source, and you've got more money in there than you would like to lose, worth probably moving it to a new Bitcoin address, freshly created with a full set of entropy bits rather than a lower number.
Or if you forgot your password, here's a chance to try to brute force it.
And there you go. Right? Exactly.
There's a silver lining.
I hadn't flipped it over like that, Leo. That's a very good point. Indeed. Along the lines of things that people didn't bother attacking once that they're now coming back to attack with new motivation. It turns out that, as we know, malicious cryptocurrency miners are looking around everywhere for any still exploitable places where they can install and run their mining software. And the devices must be connected to the internet, and optimally, they will be as fast as possible. And as we have been discussing, this, of course, places public internet servers among the ideal set of targets. So now, another old and long since known bug. It hasn't been patched because it's too old, but that doesn't keep it from being a problem. It's a bug in Microsoft's IIS version 6. IIS version 6 was the one that shipped with Windows XP and Server 2003. So old. But the WebDAV service was known and has been known to have a problem. A pair of Chinese researchers a little over a year ago discovered that an attacker can craft and send a malicious prop find request to an IIS v6 server that has WebDAV enabled. And that prop find request contains an oversized IF header, which is one of the fields in that query. When the IIS WebDAV controller reads the request, guess what? Because it's oversized, it won't surprise you that a buffer overflow occurs, allowing attackers to deliver and execute code on the targeted server. Now, due to the server's age, you know, this was 2003, right? And Windows XP. Even though today, get this, even though today IIS version 6 accounts for 11.3% of all IIS server installations. So 1 in 9 of IIS servers are still IIS version 6. The code is well past end of life and will no longer, obviously, is not going to be updated. So Shodan, a search under Shodan shows that there are a little over 600,000 publicly accessible IIS version 6 servers on the internet. The good news is WebDAV was not enabled by default. So most of those 600,000 publicly accessible IIS 6 servers do not have WebDAV enabled. But any servers that were using SharePoint Portal do have it enabled, so there are still plenty of them. And as a consequence of all of this, again, and bad guys now having a new motivation to find servers, there is a campaign running at scale, meaning, you know, internet scale, trying to find those servers and install electronium cryptocurrency mining on those machines. There are security firms tracking a campaign that is apparently being very effective. And so electronium is the cryptocurrency being mined by this campaign, installing itself into IIS6 servers that are unfortunate enough to have WebDAV enabled. If and there's, you know, potentially who knows how many. I think I saw something like 65,000 somewhere. So a substantial percentage of that 600,000 potential publicly accessible IIS servers. Yikes. And I was initially a little confused by a story about how a photo on WhatsApp of somebody's hand, which did not show their fingertips, was used as a new source of crime forensics. It was covered by the BBC and picked up by Bleeping Computer. The South Wales Police Chief Dave Thomas said that although the scale and the quality of the photograph proved a challenge, the small bits were enough to prove that the person whose hand was shown was the dealer of the drugs that were depicted in the picture. So over WhatsApp, somebody was offering some illegal drugs with the palm of their hand showing the various samples of these various pills. And although the picture wasn't enough to identify the person, because even in the photo you could not see the fingerprints, what somebody cleverly realized was that they could see a lot more. If you scroll down, I think there is a picture in their story. I think it was the BBC's coverage. So if you can find the link to the BBC story, they show the picture where you can only see a little bit of the person's hand. But because they had suspects for the crime and knew who it probably was, what they were able to do was use the photo as a further source of confirmation. And what I was reminded of was our discussion about Tor, where, as we have noted several times in the past, when traffic goes into the Tor network, you never know where it's going to come out. And Tor is so popular now, and there are so many nodes that can be weakly linked, that if you didn't know who, you know, like, where someone's traffic was connecting to, you'd be hard-pressed to figure it out. But if you suspect what the two endpoints are, it is very easy to confirm the communication once you know what it is, even though you've got Tor in the middle stirring things up and confusing things. So in other words, confirming a suspicion is not something that Tor protects. And similarly, using a photo which is insufficient to identify someone can still be used to confirm with sufficient exactitude in order to close the case. And in this case, there were 11 convictions that resulted essentially from the fact that the photo that itself didn't identify someone was enough to confirm the law enforcement suspicion. So I thought that was, you know, sort of an interesting twist. And finally, we will wrap up to this week's podcast from with one from our "You Cannot Make This Up" department. So get this, Leo. An unnamed casino located somewhere in North America. The casino is unnamed because this is a report from the casino's security forensics company that, of course, wants to leave their employer, their contractor, unknown. This unnamed casino located in North America had 10 gigabytes of its internal network data, including all of the casino's high roller database, exfiltrated to a location in Finland. That occurred through a newly installed internet-connected aquarium thermometer.
At least the fish were comfortable.
Oh, my Lord. Nicole Egan, the CEO of cybersecurity company DarkTrace, told attendees at an event in London last Thursday how cyber criminals hacked this casino through its internet-connected thermometer installed into an aquarium in the lobby of the casino. According to Egan, the hackers exploited a vulnerability in the thermostat to gain a foothold into the network. Once there, they accessed the high roller database of gamblers and additional information, then pulled it back across the network, out the thermostat, and up to the cloud. So that was a very busy thermostat for a while.
It got really hot.
And of course, yes. And this, of course, is a perfect and classic demonstration of the crucial need that we have often talked about on this podcast for network isolation and segmentation, that you really want to keep the security of things you can't vouch for or that may be suspicious, like your fish tank aquarium thermometer, which you just have to have on the internet after all, to make sure while you're traveling that your fish are comfortable. The good news is we are beginning to see Wi-Fi routers with multiple isolatable guest networks. And I think that's a great thing in this evolution. I was configuring a network the other day. It was actually an ASUS router, and I'm going to go back and make sure that it doesn't have its WAN port exposed after today's podcast. But and I must have looked at it when I was scrutinizing it, but I'm going to make sure. But it offered four isolated guest networks with options like allow guests to interact. And so you would like turn that off if you don't need the various IoT things within your home to talk to each other, yet you want them to talk to the internet. And so I would, moving forward, look for routers for your home that support multiple isolatable guest networks, because I think this is going to be a trend. And think in terms of not visitors. I mean, yes, also visitors, but give a couple of your routers' guest networks to your IoT devices. Let them have their own place to play, not on your main network. And you can imagine that this casino really wishes that they had done exactly that. So, very cool stuff. And as I said at the top of the podcast,
such a great story.
Never a dull moment.
Never a dull moment. It's the perfect name for this show. We're going to close the book on episode 659. You can watch the show, do it live in front of a live studio audience. Every Tuesday about 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC. You can watch at twit.tv/live and join us if you do in the chat room at irc.twit.tv. After the fact, you can get your own copy of the podcast for your collection. Steve's got them at his website, grc.com, the Gibson Research Corporation. If you go there, you can download it. He's got transcriptions, a giant mug. Good Lord, that's huge. and a whole lot more at grc.com. While you're there, don't forget to pick up a copy of SpinRite, his bread and butter and the world's best hard drive recovery and maintenance utility. If you use it right, you never have to use it, which is kind of a paradox.
Ooh, R-I-T-E. If you use it right,
Yeah. You never have to use it. You can also get a lot of freebies there and all sorts of information, Steve. That site is just jam-packed. It's like the back of a Dr. Bronner's peppermint soap bottle. You could just read it for days. GRC.com. We also have copies of audio and video, so you can see Steve's giant mug in space. All you have to do is go to twit.tv/SN or get your on-demand versions by subscribing in your favorite podcatcher. That way you'll get
it. And Leo, we should note to our listeners that you are off to Japan.
I am on Thursday. So either Jason Howell or Father Robert Ballester, I actually don't know. One of the other will fill in for me for the next couple of weeks. I'll be back May 7th. So we can resume this ongoing colloquy. Cool. If you have questions or comments or suggestions for Steve, he's on the Twitter at SGGRC, or you can go to grc.com/feedback. Thank you, Steve. See you next week.
Thank you, my friend. Have a great vacation, and we'll see you in 3 weeks.
Security Now.